What do the Cree Indians of Canada, bankers in Australia, farmers in India, insurance agents in Singapore, and German fitness professionals all have in common with the AT&Ts, the IBMs, and the Lockheed Martins? Well, it's my guest today, Mickey Williams. And Mickey is an international speaker, consultant, coach, author, radio and TV personality, as well as an entrepreneur extraordinaire. So not only are we going to learn more about Mickey and her rise to success, but we're going to talk about developing your sense of self. And I promise you this show will be jam-packed with shared experiences, fun, and a life worth of information, because we have you on the call today. Mickey, how are you?
I'm great, Dorothy. Thanks for the invitation. It's exciting to be speaking to you and the audience that you have.
Thank you. And I know that that introduction really didn't touch on just so many of the great careers you've had. And for the purpose of this show, Breaking the Glass Ceiling, Going Beyond Expectations, I did want to ask you, have you ever had any glass ceilings to break, which could be any limited mindsets, anything that kept you from being who you are today?
How long is this show? 8 hours?
1 hour.
Yeah, where do I begin with that question? You know, glass ceiling has, a lot of broad terms. It just doesn't mean the old one, to me anyway, where women could not reach a certain position. I think there's a financial glass ceiling. I think there's a personality glass ceiling. I think there's a persona beyond what the original term was actually meant. And it's interesting because I wear a pin that's broken glass. And when people ask me, about it, I say it's a representative of always breaking the glass ceiling. And the one that I had to deal with, well, two particular, and again, I stretched the definition of it, so I hope this is okay, but I've always lived outside the box. In fact, I don't even know there is a box. So the two that I've always dealt with, one was a financial glass ceiling. One of the reasons I probably had so many different careers and finally, after nine careers, went into my professional speaking career, because as I was looking for opportunities, I had objectives for this last career. I had four objectives, and one was travel, because I had never really done that. Two was glamour, because I come out of an entertainment. I've never met a sequin I didn't like. And so it has to have glamour. In fact, I'm convinced if I wasn't born a girl, I'd be a drag queen today. So it had to have glamour. It had to have travel. It had to have people, because I'm very people-oriented. And lastly, it had to have unlimited financial opportunity. So here's where the financial glass ceiling comes in. So I started searching for these careers, and the first one I went after was in the hospitality industry. And it had the travel, the people, and the glamour, but it had a financial glass ceiling. You'd start at the back of the house, move to the front of the house, move up the corporate ladder. And I, at that stage of my life, I decided I just didn't want to have a financial glass ceiling. I wanted to make as much money as my effort and talents would allow. So that was the first time I experienced what I call the financial glass ceiling. And then even as a professional speaker now for 27 years, there were certain industries that I was speaking in, and then I'd reach that financial glass ceiling where I found I was not only negotiating for my fees, I was like arguing for my fees when I started realizing I outgrew the industries and I had to go based on my talents and expertise. I was now at the next level. So I think financial glass ceilings are one that women have to look out for. At least those were two for me. And because I've never really had corporate experience, I did work corporate. I was a director of marketing for public television for a while, but mostly I'm an entrepreneur. But the other one that I've faced throughout my entire life is what, and I don't know what the name of it, Dorothy. I haven't really thought of a name for it. But I've always been a very flamboyant, outrageous, you know, my mantra is be outrageous. It's the only place that isn't crowded. And as a result of that, there is a glass ceiling around that. There is a perception because I'm, you know, always flamboyant and I've got sequins and everything. People would already put a ceiling on how smart I could be or how experienced I could be.
Yeah.
So that has gone with me my entire life, but I'm very comfortable with who I am. And so I consider that other people's perception problems, not mine. In fact, when I was inducted into the Speaker Hall of Fame last year, which is a highlight of all my careers, my induction speech focused on the fact that I was discriminated against for my early years in the industry. No one thought I'd be back year after year, let alone build one of the most successful careers. So I used my six-minute acceptance speech as a platform to let everybody know there was a very strong message in that. And if anybody's interested, it's on YouTube. Just go to Mickey Williams Speaker Hall of Fame induction. And I'm very proud of that six-minute speech because it really addresses what you're talking about, but a different kind of glass ceiling.
That's so well said, because I think that happens to a lot of us. For whatever reason, people size us up and think that if you're overweight or you're flamboyant or glamorous, whatever that may look like, that you're not smart. So how did you detect that? What were some of the signs that was happening to you? And what are one or two actions you took to overcome that every time it appears?
You know, that's a difficult question to answer, and I've been asked that in a lot of different formats. I was very blessed I was raised by a single working mother, which I like to say is a redundant term. But my mom always gave me the confidence to be who I am. So my other pin that I wear is WYSIWYG. And WYSIWYG, for most people, they know it comes from the days of Lotus and the computer. What you see is what you get, meaning what was on the screen is what was printed out. Well, I created a WYSIWYG pin in rhinestones, because I feel anything worth wearing is worth wearing in rhinestones or diamonds. So along with my glass pin, I have my WYSIWYG pin. And my WYSIWYG pin basically is, I am. What you see is what you get. I don't take on different roles. I'm not the speaker when I'm on stage. I'm not the mom or the friend when I'm off stage. I'm not the business person when I'm in sales. And so it's to let women and let all people know that to be authentically yourself. And that was the gift that my mother gave me. Consequently, I was never a teenager who felt the need to conform. So I never smoked or drank or did any of those things, because conformity was never part of my vocabulary. So I don't have the answer other than I think it goes deeper than the level of that question, meaning if you build enough confidence in who you are and what you have to offer, it doesn't matter what you look like, whether you're overweight or dowdy or ethnicity is different or whatever. I just believe it's an assuredness that comes from you know that you're great at what you do. And whatever people's perception of you is based on those external factors is their issue, not yours.
I agree with you. And so where would you say being yourself, like you said, being glamorous, you wear a lot of rhinestones and sequins, all those wonderful things. Where has that gotten you? Where has that benefited you to just be yourself?
Well, I think it goes back to authenticity. When people take the time to find out who I am and get past their own perceptions, they realize this isn't an act. This is not something I get up every day and deliberately say, I'm going to be outrageous today. I'm going to be out of the box. I am who I am. So whether it's flamboyant or overweight or underweight or whatever it is, it's just showing up as who you are. And that's, I know it sounds very simplistic, Dorothy, but that for me is the real thing. I think the confidence comes from within. And also I have self-effacing humor about it. You know, one of the things I teach to people, because I'm an executive speech coach and people, I just did a speaker school in Atlanta last week, and one of the things I say is get it out of the way, especially in my case. Or, I've been training some young people who are in their 20s and they're economists, and they're going out to talk about the economy to people who are 40s and 50s and CEOs of companies. So I said, let's get it out of the way. With humor. Humor is a great way to deflect or have self-effacing. It's endearing. It's authentic. So when you show up, just say, for those of you who are thinking, yes, I have my mother's permission. She lent me the car to come today, as an example. So if it's age, if it's dress, if it's hair, whatever it is, I'm all about making it more visible and having self-effacing, but not self-deprecating, because that makes people uncomfortable. Self-effacing is knowing what other people think and just playing off of it.
Oh, I like that. I like that very much. Okay, so I'm going to have you coach me on the phone here. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, sometimes when you go into the corporate entity, you're taught a lot of protocol, right? You learn to be professional,
yeah,
and you learn to use certain buzzwords, and you realize that bleeds into the rest of your own life. How do you know what your sense of self is when you feel like you've been trained by parents and by corporations and employers, et cetera, to be something that feels like it's so far away of who you really are? How do you know who you are?
You know, it's a great question, Dorothy. I don't know if you're familiar with behavioral instruments. There's many assessments out there, DISC and Myers-Briggs and Caliper and Wunderlich. They're all wonderful behavioral assessments.
Yeah.
I happen to use the DISC, and I train people on it. I was in Austin yesterday giving a seminar on it. And one of the things when you take an assessment, which I think everybody should do based on your question, is you learn you have what's called adaptive behavior to your environment. You have instinctive behavior, which comes from your genetics and your experiences, and you have your self-perception. So all of us have the ability to adapt our behavior to the environment we're in. Hence, someone working in a corporation knows to be successful, they accept the jargon, the dress code, all of the things that are within the parameters of that expected environment. Underneath it, they may be completely different because that's their instinctive behavior, which usually, by the way, shows up under stress and it's impulsive.
Yeah.
But an astute professional is aware of that, keeps it in check because knows it's not appropriate in the workplace. And then if you take your environmental adaptive behavior plus your instinctive genetic behavior, that creates your self-perception. And that self-perception is we act in accordance with who we think we are. But it comes from a lot of those things, which is understanding our strengths and our weaknesses, or understanding our strengths and maximizing those and minimizing or manages that which we're not really strong for.
You bet. I'm very familiar with DISC, and I'm certified in Myers-Briggs, and also another one, I don't know if you've heard of it, called Emergenetics. And to your great point, it's based on, you know, the blend of the environment and the instinctive self or the natural self. And also it's based in brain science and brain research. And to your point, what I love about it is assessments just give you a language. They give you a context for which to describe yourself. You kind of know who you are, but you don't know exactly how to put it into words or into concepts that you can articulate to others. And I'm like you. I love them because they really do give you a sense of self and sense of who you are. But it also gives you a little pride in knowing who you are and what you can do and what your skills and abilities are as well. So I agree. That's a great place to start.
Yeah, and you know, all of our behavior, no matter who we are, no matter what our style is really shaped by our needs, our values, our norms, and our attitudes. And if you take norms, for example, because most of my clients are in corporate or their associations or they're entrepreneurs, so I work with all of them. And one of the things I've talked about, when we talk about norms and having to fit into norms, there are norms in every aspect of our life. There are norms in your home when you have a curfew for your kids. There are norms at work when there's a dress code. There are norms in society when there's a speed limit. So we operate within the parameters of those norms so we don't get grounded at home or in jail, in society, or all the things. And then our attitude is just what shapes our perceptions around these things. And learning to adapt to the different environments and the different people, I think, is one of the success skills. That's why I always tell everybody, take every one of these behavioral instruments. Because if they all overlapped and they were all a circle, each one expands your circle a little bit more and you start to understand who you are. I am like a junkie for this stuff. I've done StrengthFinders. I've done Myers-Briggs. I've done all of them. Because each one of them reveals another interesting part about who I am and what I do and why I do it. And I think as long as you take that work in progress kind of attitude towards life and business, I think you're continuing your own growth and success.
And I'm right there with you. I'm a junkie as well. I've done a lot of workshops with Myers-Briggs or Emergenetics. I've been part of many DISC opportunities as well. And I've even taken it into my home life, which I see that you've done that too for people personally as well as professionally, and taken my husband and son through them. And it's great because, once again, it gave us a great language to talk about. You know, when I'm giving them a hard time for any of the styles and approaches they use, they remind me of their type for Myers-Briggs or their results for Emergenetics. And we have a lot of fun with it, but it's bridged so much understanding about who we are, how we tick, how we roll, et cetera. And we, like you, we're junkies, and we have a great time with it. So you have coached a lot of people, like you said, corporations and entertainment, et cetera. what is really, when, if you could just summarize it, here are the three core things people seem to all struggle with. What would be some of those familiar, common things that we all struggle with when it comes to our jobs and our career?
You know, it's interesting. I was on Good Morning Australia, and the host, and it wasn't, I didn't know ahead of time, asked me a very similar question. They said, what do you think it is every morning when people get up all over the world that they're wondering about? And instinctively, my answer, again, kind of goes back to what I've been saying along, self-esteem. I believe we all look in that proverbial mirror and say to ourselves, am I worthy? Am I good enough? Can I do it? Et cetera. So I think in terms of, you know, my experience with coaching executives and working in companies and such is always that risk-taking always seems to be a big challenge for a lot of people. You know, the old adage, you can't steal second base with your foot on first. And
yeah.
Most people seem to want to keep their foot in first.
Yeah.
Or the one I said the other day, which shocked but made everybody laugh, I said if you have one foot in the past and one foot in the future, then you piss on the present. So, you know, I'm a firm believer in that. You know, one of my most popular presentations, my signature one, talks about some very basic things, how we deal with change. Do we embrace it or do we fight it? Do we take risks and at what level? Are they calculated or we're just staying in our security? You know, so part of my mantra to people is to get uncomfortable, rather is to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I call that their discomfort zone. If you're not doing something every day that is in your discomfort zone, then I would challenge most of my people who work with me. And I always tell them when they work with me, I'm from New York, so I'm a very direct person. I'm not going to pat you on the head all the time and say you're doing a great job. I'm going to challenge your thinking. And that's part of it, is challenging people to get into their discomfort zone, get comfortable with being uncomfortable, take some risks, deal with change, and set some goals. And I think a lot of people give lip service to these things, Dorothy, but actually don't do them, in my experience.
I agree. And you know what's so interesting when you say that we all wake up in the morning and the first thing we do is just struggle with self-esteem or struggle with feeling competent and confident enough to do things. You know, it's interesting. You would never guess that about a lot of people. They all seem like they make it through and they deal with it. But it's always interesting to know that we all somewhat struggle with that. So my other question for you, too, is, you know, when you tell people there's an opportunity to build your sense of self and your confidence, what do you tell the people who really don't feel that? I was just going to say they can say the right words and they can try to fake it till they make it, but they really don't feel it. How can we feel confident and competent?
Well, I can give you two ways, again, in my experience that works, and one of them being what we call positive self-talk. I believe too many people are the first to say, I'm so stupid, I can't believe I did that, or I'm too fat, I can't believe that, and we have what's called negative self-talk. And, you know, if you look at our Olympic athletes, you could take that as an inspiration. They're not walking up to the line and going, oh, that's too far, I don't think I could run that far, or that's too high, I'll never make it. They know for years, elite athletes, what many of us mere mortals don't know, and that's the power of positive self-talk. And I think that's something that you have to practice. It doesn't come naturally. I think we're wired for negative self-talk. And to get into the habit of affirmations, whatever it is, whether you write them out, stick them on your mirror, or do it verbally in the morning, it's up to your style. I just didn't think enough people practice positive self-talk. And the other big one, huge, and I'm passionate about, is you want to raise self-esteem, get out and volunteer. Volunteer in any way. Volunteer in your community, a charity, your kid's school. Find something you can wrap your arms around. If you love animals, volunteer somewhere with animals. You love senior citizens. You love kids. You have someone battling a disease. Anything. You know, that's the number one way to raise self-esteem. It's a proven research fact, volunteerism. Get out of yourself and get into something else. And by giving yourself away, you raise your own self-esteem. You feel really good about yourself.
That's very interesting. I had never heard of that, actually. I mean, it makes sense that you're giving and doing great things for other people. And, of course, you feel good about that, but I never associated the feel-good with also the confidence and building the confidence.
Oh. Absolutely. Number one way to raise self-esteem, volunteerism.
What's also the number one requests you get from your clients?
In which area, Dorothy, because I do so many different things.
You bet. How about in career?
And again, it depends on the individual. You know, one of the things before I coach somebody, I might be coaching someone who's at a certain point and they're looking to change career. Someone else is at a certain level and they want to get to the next level. It's all different. There's no common theme. Most of my coaching now goes around executive speech coaching because I have through Vistage, where I'm a chair. Vistage is the world's largest executive organization, and I run two of those groups, and I coach those CEOs every month. So that's a lot of my business coaching. And a lot of my private coaching clients at this point are centered around the executive speech coaching. I have the occasional life coaching client and the business coaching client, but I get half of that from my existing executives. So the ones that keep coming to me now, which I'm trying to do more of, is the executive speech coaching. And interestingly enough, and this was an aha for me, as I said, I just did a speaker school in Atlanta. It was the first time I'd done it out of Chicago because I do them 4 times a year in Chicago. Someone wanted to host it in Atlanta. I said, okay, why not? And two of the people, they all wrote me thank yous and testimonials, and two of them, which just went on my LinkedIn page, I thought was really interesting. Both of them wrote that they felt my speaker school was not just a speaker school but a personal development program. And I thought that was really interesting, how they felt it gave them some self-esteem and confidence to be able to learn some of the secrets of professional speakers, but they felt it benefited them from a personal development role in business and personal.
I absolutely believe that. I think learning to do professional speaking or even working on your presence as you speak, facilitation skills, all build great self-esteem and great confidence. I would totally agree with that. Very much so. Because it does seem in corporate America that they always look to see what is your executive presence or what is your presence as far as how you relate to people, how do you articulate your thoughts and ideas. It seems like those that have really polished that piece have done extremely well in their careers because they're just good at two-way dialogues and expressing ideas and solutions.
Yeah, and what's so interesting to me about that is that most people, in my experience, don't even think about that. They just think, if they've got a gregarious personality, that's all they need to get up and give a presentation about their product or service or if they're going to sell something. And in my opinion, everybody needs coaching in terms of their either executive presence or presentation skills or sales training, because it's completely different nowadays. You know, neuroscience, cultural anthropology, all of these things have said to us now it is no longer about just getting up there and doing a data dump or a PowerPoint presentation. And I think the people who realize that are very astute and will make greater gains in their career and their personal life by getting that kind of coaching. But a lot of people still don't get it.
I agree, and my son's actually in college right now, and he is doing a lot of presentations on his thesis that he's built, and he's getting some great experience and loves it. And I said, you know, that's fantastic, because it's one of those skills that I remember early on in my career and coming out of college. I was very fearful of. If someone said someday I'd be doing a radio show, back when I was in my 20s, I would have said, no way. There is no way. Speech class was one of the last courses I took in college. I was that petrified of public speaking.
Well, sadly, it's not required, and in my opinion, it should be. And it's something I hear over and over again from not only students, but people come out and they're doctors or they've studied a specific area, and they said, you know, nobody ever taught us how to be good at presentation skills. It shouldn't be a elective. It should be a required course. We're not there yet.
I agree with you so much. And, Mickey, you have had so many careers. Do you want to speak to the listener about the different careers you've had? And tell us why you haven't, like the most of us, had one or two careers. Why have you had so many, and what do you love about that?
Yeah, I'm just crazy, like most entrepreneurs. Well, actually, you know, to answer that question, I have to take you back a little bit and not give you my signature speech, but it's a core part of it, so you do understand it. My goal in life was to be a wife and mother. That was truly my only goal in life because I was raised by a single mom My dad left when I was 4. I had no brothers and sisters, so my lifelong goal was to be a wife and mother. And as they say, when we make plans, God laughs. At the age of 29, at the age of 29, my husband was killed in a car accident, and I was left with a 2-year-old child, no job, a mortgage, and everything else you could think about it. And you might say that's one of life's defining moments. And I was not born with a MBA in my briefcase or any other business degree. So I looked at that point, I had to make a life for myself and my son, Jason. I didn't plan on being a career woman. So just to, because we weren't left with anything. So I had, because no one expects to die at 29. So we weren't really prepared. And so I looked at my natural talents, and my natural talents at that time was dancing, because I had been a professional dancer in New York. And I thought, well, I can go out there with the boom box. That's what we had in those days, for anybody who doesn't know what that is. So I'd go out with the boom box, and I teach dance. And then I was a really great cook. I loved to cook. And then someone else said, well, they'd hire me to cater a party. And before you know it, two businesses were born. I had a dance studio that became nationally known because it was very unique in its model. And I had a catering business that grew very quickly, because it had a unique name, number one. It was called The Happy Cooker. And number two, my dance studio. Well, I had started my catering business with my dance student. I think you might know of her, Martha Stewart. Well, Martha was my dance student, as was Joanne Woodward and Erica Jong and Patty Hearst and all celebrities. So those two businesses, those two businesses took off, and I realized I liked it. I was good at business. And then I also found in those two careers that I reached a point where I won the top award in both of those industries. And when I got the top award, it was kind of, well, what's next? So I guess inherently inside of me that I didn't know existed this competitive drive and this potential to reach the top. So it became kind of a theme as I look back on all these careers now that I love starting businesses. I love taking them to the point where I get the highest it was never about the money. It was always about the highest recognition in the industry. And every time I got that, I either sold the business or moved on or closed the business or whatever I did. I had everything from a C Corp to an LLC to a sub S to a sole proprietor. I just kind of done it all. Every business was different. But the common theme, I guess there were two common themes, Dorothy. One is that setting that goal and reaching it and then moving on. And also, once I did that, always going to the other side of giving back to that industry. For example, when I was a professional dancer, and then I had the school, and I was teaching, and then I was choreographing, so I was no longer the performer. I was now behind the scenes helping other people achieve that. And it's been the same thing with every career that I've had. It always kind of goes full circle where I reach the top for myself, and then I'm ready to give back and bask in the success I help others achieve. And it's even happening now with my speaking. After being, on the main stage of professional speaking for 27 years, and I still am, when I got that goal of being in the Speakers Hall of Fame, it became more about now let's coach other people to reach their goal and to celebrate their success. So each career, even though the product or service was different, they seem to have that common theme of setting that goal of recognition, not so much monetary.
So that's really fascinating. I've never really heard anybody articulate that, where you set the, I heard setting the goal, right? But then you reach the top, but yet, and then you move on. But I also like that you move on maybe to a new goal, but you're still giving back to what was the original goal or the accomplishment. I think that's really excellent. And so I wanted to ask you this. It sounds like your definition of success is, like you said, reaching the highest recognition in your industry at the time. Would you say that's your definition of success?
In business, for me, it's no. The other common theme, which I seem to find as I reflect back, is always my biggest gratification comes from the success of others. It always outweighs the personal gratification I got by getting to the top. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does.
So, so even when I was on stage as a performer and all that applause was for me, I got more out of it by being in the wings and watching someone else who I helped get there get the applause. And I'm finding the same thing now with my coaching and all the other things that I do now. I said in my speech the other day, I believe every one of my careers, and probably everybody's, Dorothy, has psychic rewards. And the psychic reward of a career for me is getting an email on any given day from somebody who was in an audience 5 years ago and said, you wouldn't remember me, but because of your speech, I did this, this, or this. Just last week I got one of these from a guy who was in my audience, and I had a challenge in this particular speech that related to a family goal. And I do a whole exercise around it, and he was wearing this purple rubber band that I gave out, and he just wrote me unsolicited, because I committed to that. My child had always been asking me to get her a bike so we could ride together, and I've always found a reason not to do it. And he said, because I committed to this goal, I went out, and my daughter and I enjoyed our first bike ride together, and now it's going to be every weekend. Thank you for that. So that, to me, turns me on more than the amount of money I get or more than the applause I get. I just love touching people's lives and basking in their accomplishment and knowing that I had some part, whether it's just inspiring or something that made them get there or teaching them something. I don't know. It's really what fuels me.
Yeah, that's excellent. I love that. And I wanted to ask you, too, you are always very successful in what you do. And what are your routines? What are your rituals for getting to your definition of success? How are you so good at so many things?
Well, it's a cliche to say I balance my life. There's a lot of challenge around saying balanced life. A lot of people might look at my life and say it's not balanced, but I have a huge network of friends. I take a huge amount of personal time for myself. I travel for personal, I have hobbies. So I like to think I enjoy everything I do because it's not one piece of it. I am a whole person, and I can't separate all the different parts. If I go to my spiritual center on Sunday, it's still part of the work person that shows up on Monday or the family person that spends time with her son on Tuesday. So I just kind of believe in this whole person concept, and I try to look at my life that way. And I think I'm able to accomplish more. I mean, people ask me all the time, because I run like 7 different businesses. But the other thing I got clear on, especially for, I think this is a big tip for a lot of people because it was a big aha for me, I'd like to say I got over the shiny object syndrome, which most entrepreneurs are guilty of, and I imagine other people are too. And the shiny object syndrome is that someone comes to me with a great idea, and I go, oh, that's great, and I want to do it. And then I do another one, and I want to do it. Because a lot of people who come to me for coaching are just that way, the way I was, very scattered, very grabbing onto every little shiny object out there. And every single thing that I do now, 7, 8, 9 different divisions of my company, all begat, for lack of a better word, all serve another piece. They're all in alignment. So nothing I'm doing now is outside of, they're all under the umbrella of Mickey Williams Unlimited. Do you know what I mean? So if someone hires me to do a speech, there's 10 people in the audience that sign up for speaker school and 10 people that hire me for speaking and 10 people who sign up for the Mickey Mouse Club. So the alignment, I think, is really important. If you want to do a lot of things and if you want to be successful, you have to ask yourself, does this fit with this? Does this fit with this?
So when we come back to the theme of your sense of self, how does this all play into who you see yourself to be? Define your sense of self.
Oh boy, that's a big question. I don't know if anybody ever asked me that, and I don't know. I'd have to take some time to think of it. Four years ago, I'm always trying to come up. Every January is renewal time for me. It's renewal time for my business. It's renewal time for the people in my Vistage group, for the people I coach. I have to come up with something new every year to not only challenge them but to challenge myself. I mean, for example, if I'm challenging my Vistage members, these are all CEOs, to set goals, I'm just not going to settle into a routine of giving them the same format for goal setting every year. Because that, whether it's boring to them or not, it's going to be boring to me and it doesn't challenge me. So everything I do has to challenge me as well. I've learned that about me. So I'm going to find some new way to set goals. So about 4 years ago, Bonnie, I have my Florida home now. I live in Chicago, but I have a Florida home. So in January, I come here. I take 2 weeks, and I know it's hard for a lot of people to believe who know me, but I really don't talk to anyone or do anything because the rest of my life is always so full. And I got the idea a couple years ago to come up with a theme for my year. And my theme would drive a lot of my actions for the year.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. So my first year, this was 3 years ago, my theme was intention. And then I kind of had to define it. What does that mean? So it means that everything I say yes to, personally, professionally, spiritually, has to be done with an intention of what? So I just don't arbitrarily agree to things or turn things down, whatever. So I had to clearly look at all my decisions that year with intention. The year after that, ironically, although I shouldn't say ironically, you can say serendipitously, synchronicity, my theme was inclusion. And that was the year I went on a spiritual search and looked for, instead of a religious affiliation, a spiritual center that was very inclusive, meaning there were every ethnicity, there was every sexual orientation, there was every economic differentiation, because I was really about inclusion. And interestingly enough, turned out to be the year I got my Speakers Hall of Fame, and my speech was about inclusion. This year, my theme, this past year, my theme was gratitude. So the first thing I did after I decided on the theme was to go out and get a gratitude journal and to write in it every day. And trust me, I don't want to sound like a saint here. There are days, Dorothy, that when I write in my gratitude journal, the only thing that I can write is I'm grateful that this pen is writing.
So you don't always have to be perfect every time you enter that.
No. I always say people think inspirational speakers that we're just happy all the time and we lead perfect lives. No. I'm incredibly human. So my theme, I'm already thinking about my theme for 2015, and I believe right now it's going to be kindness. And then I always have to define it. What does that look like? And so that's going to include some kind of specific random act of kindness on a certain amount of times every month. So my themes have really been a big part of my life for these couple of years. It's really, so when you say define yourself, I go back to that whole person concept. There's no one singular thing. I just explore the different dimensions of myself every year. Like I said, last year was finding that spiritual home. And so each year there's a kind of another exploratory part of self, which contributes to that whole person.
And I would say it sounds like that's what led you to a lot of different opportunities and careers. Just I love your curiosity and your sense of self to explore. I wanted to ask you, too, as you talk about these yearly themes, I think this is such a great model. How do you choose them? Is it something you feel like is missing in your life? Is it something that you want to build out more in your life? What drives
you? I think when I first decided to do it, it was more about having a sense of purpose and direction. I guess, the more I coach people and the more I experience through them the challenges they face, the more I, it's like physician heal thyself. So it's kind of like, what has that taught me? What did I learn from that experience or from that person? And I guess there was something that first year that said, are you just going to meander through a year and just set New Year's resolutions and just set goals? I thought there was something bigger than that. So I just came up with the idea of having that theme that would be the overriding thing, and the goals and the New Year's resolutions and all that stuff would kind of fit under. It would give me a checkpoint to say, well, is that really a goal that relates to intention? What's your goal when it comes to inclusion? So I can tie back my actions to the theme. Maybe I got it from the fact that I do a lot of conferences. I keynote a lot of conferences, and the majority of them have themes. And the themes drive the speakers that they get. The themes drive the content that they want. So I guess I started subliminally buying into that by thinking that if I had a theme, it would give me more direction in my life for the year. And it's proven to be, for me, something really valuable.
So do you then reflect at the very end of the year? I know you said you set the theme as part of the new year. Do you reflect at the end of the year, this is what has come to fruition based on the theme I chose? And also tell me just some of the great things that have happened as a result of focusing on the theme throughout the year. So reflection and focusing on what types of results are you seeing?
Yeah, definitely the reflection. I mean, that's the first part before I even, like I said, I'm already thinking about what the theme would be. So I kind of start ruminating on this even before. It's not like I set a specific day, pow, I've got the theme. So right about this time of year, Thanksgiving, holidays, et cetera, that's when I start thinking about it. When January comes, I do reflect back over the year, and I say, what did I do or what happened to me as a result of that theme? And so if I look back over the year of gratitude, yeah, I've had a lot of challenges this year in a lot of different areas of my life. And if I hadn't focused on forcing myself to be grateful every day and finding the things to be grateful for, I don't know if I would have gotten through some of those things as well as I have. So I think the focus on the gratitude and the journal deliberately forced me to look at, yeah, even though this is bad and you're challenged by this, look at all this good stuff, if that makes sense to you.
The
same thing with the inclusion year. My gosh, there was no better way for me to be inducted into the Speaker Hall of Fame on my year where my theme was inclusion, because my whole six-minute speech is about inclusion, about how we judge people prematurely and challenging people to open up their minds and not be so judgmental. Because this is all about inclusion. And that was the year I found my spiritual center. So, gosh, yeah, it's like the universe kind of directs me to the theme.
Oh, that's fantastic. I have to tell you, I'm going to adopt this one. This is excellent. Because, like you said, it almost becomes your North Star for the year. It becomes
absolutely. That's a great way to put it. It does.
It's just setting that sense of direction. So, and like you said, maybe that's a great question around the show being around sense of self. Do you think a sense of self is something we're born with, or do you think it's something we shape as we live our lives?
Oh, I definitely think it's something we shape. It's affected by how our parents, our childhood experiences, and our environment. I truly believe that. I absolutely do. You know, interestingly enough, when I talk about the theme and all the other things that make me focus on stuff like that, I talk about in my speech, I don't like the term bucket list. I find that very negative to define as things to do before I die. And long before someone came up with the term bucket list, when I became that young widow, I had created something called an experience list. And only to find out, I think there's more value in my experience list than in a bucket list for two reasons. Number one, a bucket list to me, as I said, it sounds negative, things to do before I die, where experience lists are things to experience while being fully alive. And here's the second difference. Most people on their bucket list kind of bullet things. I want to go to Paris. I want to drive a Mercedes car. I want to buy. And again, I go back to, and I study these now, neuroscience and cultural anthropology, that we're no longer the left brain, right brain person. We are now thinking as we were wired for stories years and years ago, ancestry, thousands of years, that our mind only grasps and holds on to the stories we create. So my experience list, and I use this as an example in the speech, I actually read some of it out loud. I said, on a bucket list, you might write, I want to go to the Indy 500. And on my bucket list is I want to drive at the Indy 500. Or you might write, I want to go to the Kentucky Derby. And on my bucket list, it says, I want to sit in Millionaire's Row at the Kentucky Derby sipping a mint julep wearing an outrageous hat.
Yes.
So I believe when you create the experiences on paper, you manifest them. Hence, I did drive at the Indy 500. I have done most of the things on my experience list that I keep adding to. And so I'm trying to teach people in my speeches to get rid of the bucket list name and idea and format and come over to the experience list and to think big. And as if I may quote myself, I say, you got to put it out to the universe. And if that's too Gandhi for some of you, get over it. Because I believe when you put it out to the universe responds in kind. And I'm living proof.
That's fantastic. So you have to tell the story. How did you get into the Indy 500?
Well, I had my list. And it was on my list. And as I said, the universe will manifest because you wind up talking about it. It's a living, breathing document. And one day, a gal named Courtney Cole, who was in my audience, came up to me and said, I can probably make your indie dreams come true. And I said, how is that? And she said, well, I have a General Motor dealership, and we have a big presence at the Indy every year. And, you know, I really believe, Dorothy, that people love to help you get what you want. But I think, first of all, you have to know what it is you want, and then you have to put it down on paper, two things that most people don't do. So long story short, I stayed in touch with her. I'm very tenacious. That's a characteristic, you know, if I go back to a success skill in business, I'm very tenacious. I don't give up when most people do. And I stayed in touch, not knowing what she could do for me, but not judging anybody, and thinking I might have a really great seat. She'll get me a ticket. And it turned out to be way more than that. When I got there on Saturday, I was given a yellow Corvette convertible with 300 other guests. We got to drive the Indy track for two laps. We parked the cars. We had a barbecue in the center of the track. And then Sunday for the Indy race, thinking I'd have a great seat, I was given a Silverado truck with each branch of the military standing in my truck. I got to be the first one to drive on the Indy track as 300,000 people cheered. I did two laps. And then after that, I was invited into the General Motors executive suite to listen to the drivers, talk to their pit crews on a headset I was wearing, blah, blah, blah.
That is fantastic. You are so inspirational. That is just so, you know, you have done so many great things. So now I want to ask you, what was the toughest life lesson to learn?
Oh, boy. Dorothy, you asked really good questions. You're going to have me thinking about both of these long after this. The toughest life lesson to learn, I think, as a woman. Here's a lesson that I learned as a woman. I was, if you remember, wanting to be just a wife and mother.
Yes.
And when I did get married, I gave up all responsibilities, thinking the man handles the finance, the man handles this, the man, I was your, you know, back then, this is what you did. And if anything, when I get to speak to women audiences, I love telling that story because I want it to be inspirational, that I've learned no matter how great your marriage is or anything else, there are a certain amount of things, especially as women, that we can't fall back on, oh, the guy will handle that. I think part of that sense of self, it goes back to the question, is knowing that I'm self-sufficient, whether I'm married, whether I'm single, whether I'm divorced, whether I'm poor, whether I'm rich. And I think that lesson was a hard one because I was so unprepared for that at that stage of life. And so I think part of me now is like I'm never going to be that vulnerable again. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that I just always feel that I have to have a certain amount of self-sufficiency and not use excuses that might put me in challenging situations in my life. And I think that was one of the biggest lessons.
I totally agree. I have probably a similar lesson in that. I always thought the answers were outside of myself. Like, you know, the masses probably know the right answers. I should do, you know, what other people do. And I just always thought everyone else had the, you know, if the masses were doing it, it was the right answer versus understanding, no, the right answer is my answer and what I want to do, what I think's right. I guess I was just kind of like you said, it's about conformity should never be in your vocabulary. I think I was a big conformist for a long time until it just didn't work. And finally, you know, when I just, go ahead.
I think that other sense of self, which I've kind of learned by being a Vistage chair and leading, you know, corporate executives who are running bigger businesses than I ever did, who are smarter than me in a lot of ways, et cetera, is also, you know, one of the, in the book, The Five Temptations of a CEO by Patrick Lencioni. He says one of the biggest temptations or challenges for a CEO is to be vulnerable. So one of the things I've learned and gotten very comfortable with, I'm not good at everything, and I don't have an ego around the fact of the things I'm not good at. So let me maximize the things I'm good at, and let me delegate the things I'm not good at. And case in point, you know, running these executive groups, finances were never my strength, and they weren't something I enjoyed. But sales and marketing has always been my strength, and I absolutely loved it. So I delegate the pieces of all my businesses. You know, I always say hire it, learn it, or delegate it. Those are your three choices. But don't try to fake it till you make it. That's never worked for me. So I think that goes back to the whole thing about authenticity and being a WYSIWYG. I am who I am, and I have no ego around saying, gee, I'm not good at that, or I can't do that, because I'll either learn it, hire it, or delegate it. And I'm real comfortable with that.
That's great advice. I like that very, very much. So as we come toward the close of our show, Nikki, tell the listener how we can learn more about you and what you do.
Well, I have a website, mickeywilliams.com, which is going to be completely redone in January. So I'm excited about that because I haven't touched it in 20 years or so. But because I liked it, it'll either scare you to pieces or you'll say, wow, this is cool. So everything is on my website. You know, as I said, Mickey Williams Unlimited is an umbrella for a lot of the things I do. I run these executive groups with Vistage International, and they're always looking for more chairs and more speakers and more members. If anyone's interested in that, I'm an executive speech coach. I do that one-on-one with people all over the country, either in person or by Skype or by phone. I run speaker schools now 5 times a year. We keep adding them, 2.5-day speaker schools. And, again, they're listed on the website when they are. These are all individual links on the website. I have a monthly newsletter called Here She Is, and that's I'm really proud of that newsletter. It's fun. It's informative. It's colorful. It's outrageous. So anybody who wants to be on that, you could sign up for that on the website. I have a blog. I'm on all social media. I have the Mickey Mouse Club, Mickey Mouse Club. And that has three divisions, and that'll be kicking off again, a part of it in January. Some of it is going on now. And I have Outrageous Orators, where I book other speakers. What else? I think I've covered most of the things I do. So hopefully if anybody's interested in any of those things, you can email me directly at Mickey, M-I-K-K-I, at MickeyWilliams.com. And always happy to get in touch with people or support their efforts in any way I can.
You are outrageously inspirational, and I have enjoyed this time with you. I think you definitely have an attitude that there's nothing you can't do. Would you say that's the attitude you carry? How would you sum that up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's nothing I can't do, and I think there's nobody I can't meet. It's just all about leveraging what you know or who you know to assume all those other things. You know, as I like to say, Dorothy, you know, the old expression, what's the worst thing going to happen to you? Well, it kind of did. So after that happened to me, I embraced change, I embraced risk, and a lot of the things that most people are scared of, and I think that's because of that defining moment in my life. And that's what I'm getting to do now, is inspire others not to wait till a tragedy spurs you on to that or any other defining moment, but to use your God-given talents, your untapped potential to deal with those things to become successful in whatever way you define success.
I think that was just the best way to end the show. That was great advice, Mickey, and thank you so much. And for the listener, please look at Mickey Williams' website, mickeywilliams.com. She's fun. You're just so, I just love everything you shared today. I've learned so much from you. Once again, you are just someone I would love to be, and you definitely set me on the right path to share and take on some of those things that you've done in your life to be successful. And like I said, I'm going to steal some of those from you and work on those for myself. So I hope for you, the listener, you'll do the same. Thanks again for listening to Breaking the Glass Ceiling, Going Beyond Expectations. Here's to your success, and have a great week.